They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The last time this happened, gas was about 60 cents a gallon. General Motors was in the process of selling more than 6 million cars and commanding almost half the American market. As we all know, none of those things are true now, and that goes a long way to explaining why GM assembly lines are silent today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. It's Monday today, the 24th of September. They call them deadlines for a reason. And this morning at 11 o'clock, General Motors ran smack up against one. 73,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union walked off the job and onto the picket lines. It's the first nationwide strike against an American carmaker since 1976. The two sides have been negotiating since July. Right up to the very end today, all signs were positive. So we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to explain where things got off track.
When the negotiations started, the big issue on the table was health care costs and whether workers would accept a trust fund that would pay for those benefits while taking the cost of health care off the company's books. But it looks like the trust fund's turning out to be the easy part. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger said today the sticking points are job security and other benefits. Greg Gardner is an analyst with Harbor Consulting. He guesses both sides feel like they compromised a lot on the trust fund talks. The UAW thinks it deserves a break for agreeing to the fund at all. And then there's GM.
That was the major issue, and they weren't going to give ground on other issues.
For now, the strike doesn't seem to be much more than a PR problem for GM. In fact, GM's shares were trading high all day. But GM didn't stockpile cars, so if the strike continues, it could cause all sorts of problems. Bob Schultz of Standard & Poor's says both sides still know they have to compromise to survive.
I'm sure realize that having General Motors continue on in its restructuring plan and continue to make progress is in the best interest of their membership longer term.
In fact, GM's workers may be on the streets, but management and the union are already back at the bargaining table. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The union's as set as it can be for this strike. The UAW has about $800 million in its strike fund. That's enough to give everybody walking the pickets $200 a day and medical benefits for as long as 2 months. Earlier this afternoon, we got Doug Rademacher on the phone. He's the president of UAW Local 602. That's in Lansing, Michigan. Mr. Rademacher, it's Kai Rizdahl at Marketplace. How are you?
Hi, Kai. I'm doing well today. We've had better days in my 29 years, but we're doing well.
I'm sure. Where have we caught you, sir?
Lansing, Michigan. I'm at the Lansing Delta Township Assembly Plant. I've got 3,600 members. We run about 1,200 per shift. We run round the clock, so we ensure the top quality product that comes out of this plant, which is the new Saturn Outlook, GMC Acadia, and the Buick Enclave. And The line never stops running.
It doesn't stop running until today, I guess that is, right?
Well, there you go, yeah.
In your mind, Mr. Rademacher, what is this strike about?
The strike is about taking care of workers, active and retired, with health care and compensation that will afford them a decent, respectable standard of living throughout their final years.
Let me break it down into the two parts that that certainly all the press has been focusing on. First of all, the health care trust fund. Are you satisfied with the way negotiations were going on that point?
Of course, I'm not inside that room. I don't know all the numbers, obviously, but we understand it's a problem, and we're willing to help take that on and take the responsibility of that over. That's definitely a change in the last 70 years.
And on the issue of job security, Mr. Rademacher, you in essence are sort of betting on the come here that General Motors is going to be around to provide jobs to your members, aren't you?
Absolutely. You know, 4 years ago, two groups of professionals sat down at a table. They worked hard and they came to an agreement, and we stand behind that. At the same time, it afforded General Motors Corporation to invest globally, to hire brand new workforces in other countries, brand new plants in Russia, brand new plants in China, brand new plants in India. All over this world, they've been developing and growing and hiring lower wage workers. At the same time, that agreement 4 years ago has afforded top management of General Motors to receive their multi-million dollar wages. You haven't heard of any of them giving those up.
I guess my point, though, sir, is that the union hoping that General Motors is going to be around strikes me as a risky negotiating tactic.
We expect the company to recognize what we offer here as far as the highest productive workforce in the world and stand behind us as we've, again, provided them the revenues to grow globally.
How long do you think you're going to be out there on the picket lines, Mr. Rademacher?
I hope this thing comes to an end tonight. But
yeah, but what do you really think?
Well, I got to believe the fragility of the domestic auto industry, I don't see this thing going on very long.
Temperature and weather working for you for now, I suppose, huh?
Oh, it's too hot. It's actually 85 here in Michigan.
Doug Rademacher is the president of UAW Local 602 in Lansing, Michigan. Mr. Rademacher, thanks a lot for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Shares in General Motors finished lower given the news of the day. Could have been a whole lot worse, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United Nations General Assembly is having its annual meeting this week. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has put climate change right up at the top of the agenda. And today in New York, talks aimed at a new global warming treaty began. But some of the world's largest corporations may be beating diplomats to the punch. Walmart announced it will start asking its suppliers to measure and report their climate warming carbon emissions. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Walmart hopes to measure the amount of energy used by its suppliers to manufacture and ship a sample group of products. Jim Stanway heads Walmart's Global Supply Chain Initiatives. He says carbon emissions not only harm the environment, they cost money.
And if we can remove those costs through applying technology, then it fits very well with our business model, because we can then pass those cost reductions and savings through to customers in the form of lower prices.
Only 30 companies are taking part in Walmart's emissions reporting project. The retailer has more than 60,000 suppliers worldwide. And with today's announcement touting voluntary agreements with suppliers like Fox Home Entertainment and Coca-Cola, companies that are already trying to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, some doubt the project will have enough of an impact.
The real question is how far Walmart's going to go into places like China.
Yale environmental law professor Daniel Estee says China is fast approaching the U.S. as the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter. Much of that pollution, he says, comes from energy-hungry factories churning out products for Walmart.
So if we don't get our arms around the supply chain activities that stretch to China and other parts of the developing world, then we can't really claim that we have a path forward that will solve the problem over time.
Walmart wouldn't say whether Chinese suppliers would eventually be included in the project. The retail giant has no plans to make emissions reporting mandatory for any of its suppliers. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
There was this idea that started making the rounds a year or two ago, a $100 laptop designed for kids in poor countries. A group that had its roots at MIT was pushing the project. Their plans hit a snag, though, in part with actually delivering that $100 price tag. So today, the group known as One Laptop Per Child rebooted its business plan. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has that story.
The so-called XO laptop is having trouble gaining traction, largely because it's not a mainstream consumer product.
They have a real chicken and egg problem.
Josh Burnoff at Forrester Research says the plan was to offer only giant size orders, a 250,000 computers or more, directly to national governments. But that was also a stumbling block.
People won't sign up in these countries until the laptop is proven, and the laptop can't be proven until a bunch of them have been delivered to somebody.
It will take millions of sales to reach that $100 price point. And One Laptop Per Child also has to cut out the marketing and distribution costs that can make up half of a traditional laptop's price. So the group is offering this deal to American and Canadian consumers for 2 weeks in November. Buy two XOs for $399 total, and one of them will go to a kid overseas. Walter Bender at One Laptop Per Child admits this wasn't Plan A, but he says it does meet some of the organization's other goals.
We certainly want to get not just the American consumer, but children, teachers, parents, anyone who can actually contribute to learning both here in the United States and around the world involved in this project.
Bender says three parties win with this approach. The project's sales are jump-started. Developing countries get to road test the XO, and North American consumers get a talked-about computer by Christmas plus a chance to do some good. By the way, half the purchase price counts as a charitable donation as well, so that's a tax deduction. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Shades of the dot-com boom hit the tech market today. The Wall Street Journal reported this afternoon that Microsoft is considering a bid for the social networking site Facebook. It would put the value of that company at more than $10 billion, which makes the $500 million that Journal owner Rupert Murdoch paid for MySpace a year or so ago look kind of like a bargain now, doesn't it? Imagine not having to pay anything to use a cell phone. It could happen if you agree to give advertisers information about what you like, what you don't like, that kind of thing. It sounds all well and good, but here's the hitch, and you knew it was coming. Those advertisers will get their information from a company that listens in on your conversations. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports now on eavesdropping as the new business model.
Ariel Meislow spent 10 years in Israeli military intelligence. Ask him if he did any eavesdropping on the job.
No comments.
Meislow's recently started putting media in Silicon Valley. The company launched a new internet phone service today. It listens in on your telephone conversations and flashes ads and news on your computer screen related to what you are talking about.
For example, talking about food, then we bring in a piece of content about sushi.
Meislow's wants to make telephone service free to the public. This way, advertisers pay, a bit like network television. David Parmet is a marketing and public relations consultant for internet companies. He questions whether people will talk about intimate subjects while Big Brother is listening.
Well, I think as a consumer, I would have problems with it. One is the obvious ick factor that no matter how many fail-safes they say are in place, it still feels as if someone is listening in on my phone calls.
Meislow says there are no live people listening in. Computers equipped with speech recognition software pick out keywords and match them to news and ads.
The call itself isn't recorded, and actually nothing that's said is left in the system. You know, at the end of the call, we don't remember anything.
The conversation you have is supposed to govern what ads you see, but there's a twist. Meislow's is found in longer conversations. It's the ads that drive what we talk about. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The same scenario that has brought General Motors and the American auto industry low, that is, cheaper imports and falling domestic sales, is playing out now over in Germany's Ruhr Valley. Coal mines and steel factories there drove Germany's recovery from the Second World War. But Kyle James reports modern economic realities are changing a way of life.
Benno Henschen has never had a tan. That's because the 49-year-old has spent nearly every working day since he was 14 underground, operating the machines that look for hard coal thousands of feet below the surface. It's grueling work, and when Henschen comes up from the pit, he's exhausted and covered in black coal dust. But that doesn't matter.
Henschen, whose father and grandfather also worked the mines, is doing the work he says he was meant to do.
I've always wanted to be a miner, and I still love my job, but I'm worried about the future. I'm not sure where I'm going to go.
Neither are many of the other 35,000 hard coal miners in Germany. Mines have been closing for years, and remaining ones have only been able to operate thanks to $3.5 billion a year in subsidies. Now Berlin has said enough and is phasing out the support. When the subsidies end in 2018, hard coal mining in Germany will cease. When coal can be imported from Australia or the U.S. much more cheaply, why bother mining it at home? That's according to Oliver Wittke, the transportation minister of Germany's main coal mining state.
There's no reason to use public money to subsidize hard coal mining. On the global market, a ton of hard coal can be had for about 50 euros, but a ton here costs 180. Domestic hard coal is simply not competitive.
It might make economic sense to say Auf Wiedersehen to coal. For many, though, the emotional bonds to the black stuff are not so easy to put aside.
Glück auf, der Steiger kommt.
Mining looms large in the German consciousness. Soccer fans in the Ruhr Valley sing about mining at every home game. Miners have their own vocabulary, traditions, and a camaraderie you probably won't find at your basic grouping of cubicles. Again, miner Benno Henschen.
The conditions down there mean we have to respect each other and be able to depend on one another. Now that solidarity is being pulled apart, along with mining families. That's a real shame.
But those in favor of ending the subsidies say the miners have nothing to complain about. The German government doesn't want to throw the place into economic chaos. It's pledged to avoid layoffs, and it's providing billions to send miners into early retirement or train them for jobs above ground. Christoph Beike is a spokesman for DSK, which owns the country's remaining eight mines.
We have employees who look for new jobs for them. We help them with special education for a new job, and perhaps we give a little start help when they go into a new job. So I think we do a lot of things for our miners.
Meanwhile, the whole Ruhr region is slowly reinventing itself. It has to. The decline of the coal and steel industries ravaged the region's economy. Just a few years ago, unemployment was at 20%. Now, instead of the rumble of coal conveyor belts, you're more likely to hear the low hum of computers or works from sound artists. Huge abandoned industrial sites are being transformed into art galleries, theaters, or high-tech research centers. And new jobs are being created. Coal, it's the past. Shipping, chemicals, and health services are the future. It all looks good on the balance sheet and in the boardroom, but for many, it does little to move the soul, as the image of the soot-covered man in a hard hat has in this country for so long. In Germany's Ruhr region, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Coming up, making choices before the wells run dry.
What is more valuable? Is it lawns and swimming pools and golf courses, or is it crops?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 61 points, 0.4% to 13,759. The NASDAQ down about 3 points, 0.1% to 2667. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, 0.5%, ended the day at 1517. Banks felt the pinch. Citigroup slid nearly 2%, while Deutsche Bank shaved off nearly 2.25%. Homebuilder Lennar tumbled 4.5%. KB Homes fell more than 5.5% on the prospect of bulging inventories and declining sales. Stocks actually started the morning higher, but the mood soured after GM announced that strike. Its shares fell 0.5%, though Ford revved up nearly 3%. That after it announced that it would be in the black by 2009. Bond prices rose. The yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note fell to 4.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. and by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
State Book, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for August. In New York, President Bush meets with the UN Secretary General before addressing the General Assembly. And the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee holds a hearing on green jobs created by efforts to limit global warming. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The acting Secretary of Agriculture made his first public remarks today since he got the job. Chuck Connor was promoted when Mike Johanns resigned last week, perhaps to run for the Senate from Nebraska. Today, Mr. Connor called on Congress to pass the huge farm bill that's been tied up in negotiations for months. Crop subsidies are the big issue. How much government support farmers and growers ought to get. Commentator and business historian John Steele Gordon says getting more people off the land would be the best sign of progress.
Last year, only a bit more than a third of the world's workers were in farming, while fully 42% were in services and the rest in industry. If history is any guide, that's good news. Once upon a time, everyone lived at roughly the same economic level as hunter-gatherers. People moved to follow game and didn't own much. Life was hard. The invention of agriculture greatly increased the food supply, so people settled down and did things other than forage. But until the Industrial Revolution, few could be kings, priests, artisans, and merchants. 85% of the human race tilled the soil and lived in wretched poverty, while the aristocracy had all the fun and all the power. The Industrial Revolution enabled a massive increase in wealth over two centuries. Mechanization allowed more and more people to leave the fields for better-paying jobs in industry and increasingly services. A dominant middle class emerged. Today in the United States and Europe, less than 2% of all workers are in agriculture, more than enough to provide abundant exports. Food is cheap relative to income. In the developing world, things are brighter. The number of working poor in East Asia has been cut in half in just the last 10 years. Indeed, every region of the world, except sub-Saharan Africa, is growing economically, often quickly. This could transform the human situation in an historical flash. South Korea was among the poorest nations in 1960. Today, less than 50 years later, South Korea is a rich and overwhelmingly middle-class, first-world country. Its people buy flat-screen TVs and send their kids to college. If what happened in South Korea continues to spread to other countries, in 50 years, the grinding poverty that was for so long the lot of most people might become just a fading memory. Now, wouldn't that be something?
Business historian John Steele Gordon is the author of the book An Empire of Wealth. Share your thoughts with us online is the best way to do that. Our website is marketplace.org. It rained here in Los Angeles over the weekend, poured, in fact, and it was great because it's been a long, dry summer here and across the rest of the Southwest. Climate experts say it's only going to get worse, which has made one already scarce commodity all the more precious. Stacey Vanek Smith reports now on the competition for water between cities and the countryside.
Agriculture uses about 80% of the water in the Southwest. Farmers and ranchers also pay less for their water than urbanites do, thanks to government subsidies. Now drought-stricken cities from Phoenix to Salt Lake City are looking to divert water from rural communities. John Hart is a professor of environmental science at Berkeley.
The whole Southwest should be worried. We're in for some big conflicts over what will be the wisest and best use of water. We also are likely to see pressure to reduce the water supply to farms in order to maintain water supplies for large cities.
One of those large cities is Las Vegas. It's been in the grips of a serious drought for nearly a decade. Outside the Bellagio Casino, a 20-million-gallon fountain shoots water into the 105-degree air. Doug Bennett is the conservation manager for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. He says the Bellagio's fountain actually uses recycled water. He says the casinos, along with everyone else, have gotten very thrifty with water, but conservation isn't enough.
We absolutely have to conserve and use efficiently the resources we have. But even then, there's going to be a need for additional resources.
Las Vegas wants to pipe water in from the northeastern part of Nevada, about 300 miles away. The additional water would supply about 500,000 new homes. The pipeline would cost the city upwards of $5 billion and still has to be approved by the state. But Bennett says Vegas needs the water to accommodate the more than 200 people who move there every day. But critics in northeastern Nevada say the Vegas pipeline would be disastrous. Susan Lynn is with the Great Basin Water Network.
What it could do is dry up a lot of springs, lower the water table in the ground so that plants cannot reach any water, so they die off. And when the plants die off, then we have the dust.
Dean Baker is seeing more and more dust these days. He's farmed and ranched in northeastern Nevada for more than 50 years. Walking through a field on his ranch, he points to what looks like a sand dune.
This used to be a pond that 25 years ago, there would have been ducks flying off of it when we walked up here.
Baker says overpumping is to blame for the pond's disappearance. He says Las Vegas has been buying up local ranches and their water rights at above market prices to get rid of opposition.
Surely they know that if they take the water out, that it will lower the water table to the point that it changes and dries meadows and whatnot up. If they really aren't going to hurt anything, why did they need to buy all the ranches?
The Water Authority's Doug Bennett answered that question this way.
We're looking at using water from within the state of Nevada that has not been appropriated to anyone else and that the state engineer will say can be taken without impact.
Bennett says this water would be a sustainable resource, but Susan Lynn of the Great Basin Water Network disagrees and says the city should look elsewhere for more water and tighten its belt even more.
What is more valuable? Is it lawns and swimming pools and golf courses, or is it crops, or is it people's lifestyles who choose the rural lifestyle? These are choices we're going to have to be making, and the choices are not easy.
Lynn says those tough choices will have to be made all over the Southwest. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to follow up on something Bob Moon reported for us last week. His series on the music industry and online piracy told the story of Tanya Anderson. She's the Oregon woman the Recording Industry Association of America sued for illegally downloading music. Well, Friday afternoon, a federal magistrate ordered the recording industry to pay her legal costs. He essentially ruled the industry went fishing for evidence and didn't find any. The case is far from over, but if you want to catch up, you can find Bob's series on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow down 61 points on the GM strike. That's 0.4%. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dipped 8 points. That's about 0.5% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, eco-friendly products step out with some snazzy new names.
Green 2.0, Greenside, Triple Green, Green Silk, smooth.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.